Welcome back, Rhetoric Warriors Podcast. We're straightening out the curves, the linguistic curves out there, making sure you don't go over the guardrails and crash out into the rhetorical valleys. So, this podcast is built around the idea that most of us need some more sophisticated training and persuasion these days. Trump came along and broke politics for us. And so people need some more ideas about how to talk to each other. I'm Dr. Dan, American rhetorician, escaped professor, late night comedy writer, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. The purpose of the podcast, three things. I talk to comedians about their politics and their careers, and I talk to comedy pros, and that's just fun. I have conservatives on, and I convert them because the right fascinates and worries me. And so that's super fun. And then I talk to persuasion pros and rhetoricians and give out some free education for those who do want to dive deeper into this stuff. This week's guest, just a good dude. I've known this dude for quite a while, off and on through Austin, Texas. He was a writer for Seinfeld, big career. I mean, longtime stand-up comic, playwright with multiple shows and productions still all around the country. Has a new podcast interviewing the luminaries of the creative world, creativity and captivity. From Sweetwood Productions here in Austin, Texas, Mr. Pat Hazel.
I have made it. I'm on Rhetoric Warriors.
You are?
Yes.
You ready to go to war for rhetoric?
I kind of, you know, it's funny that when I hear the word rhetoric, I remember I started a book, just a handwritten book called Do You Hate Rhetorical Questions As Much As I Do?
Nice.
And every page was only a question that, you know, what do you plant to get a seedless watermelon or whatever? There was no any of them. And it was really fun. I mean, I did that in my early days of LA. Was I just thought, but it was a very difficult concept to get people to buy comedically, because they then felt like there had to be a punchline, like the punchline being built into the question confused them.
Yeah, those kind of dangling structure where you throw the joke out into their minds, they have to put it together in their mind.
Right. So I mean, I tried really hard to read from the book on stage, and people would go, yeah, but what about the punchline? I was like, that you just missed it. It was in the setup.
Yeah, I love those jokes. I had a joke that kind of had a weird life of its own. And the joke was, do you think, did great scientists ever get together? Like, did Dr. Celsius and Dr. Fahrenheit ever hang out? Like, maybe they're getting a beer and Celsius or Fahrenheit would have been like, man, it's hot out here tonight. And Celsius would have said, ah, it's not that hot.
Right. That's funny. You know,
and you gotta, and that joke actually made it into the New York Times quote acrostic puzzle. It was the answer to one of the New York Times crossword puzzles, where if you did the joke, the whole thing, you got the joke and then my name. Randomly, I didn't submit it. It just got
plucked. Wow. Well, thankfully they were quoting you. I think that's one of the things in comedy that often gets overlooked is the quote.
Yeah, that seedless watermelon joke is going to go everywhere now.
Well, you can have it. Once Facebook was invented, I realized that I was writing comedy for cruise ship comedians, because they would be in the middle of nowhere and flooded with new material from other people that were writing posts.
That's funny. You remember the Leno story about somebody asking him about people stealing jokes? And he's like, yeah, it's like, you know, I make more. Like, whatever.
That's the right attitude. I do. I was once in Minneapolis backstage of they had a kind of a backstage at the Guthrie kind of stand-up show. And I was fairly young, but I was absolutely aware that joke stealing was a thing. And I remember hearing two comics, like through a curtain, I could hear them arguing. And one said to the other, hey, you stole my Jay Leno joke. Meaning he had already stolen it from Jay, but you can't steal it from me, you know?
Great. Yeah, there's a whole world. Like, you and I are both hardcore joke writers too. You know, we also do the performance stuff here and there. You're more of an actor than I am, but we're hardcore joke people, right? That's sort of one of the things we do, just sit around and just like blowtorch jokes into shape and send them out in the world.
You know, it's a different kind of discipline, but it's also perspective. You cannot look at something and not see humor in it. And then you just try to ratchet it down into the tightest version of that, you know, the shortest version, or waterproof so it can go underwater, or bulletproof so they can't shoot a hole in it. Like, that's the fun of it, I think.
Do you think that's still, that's become old school, like really wrangling jokes that tightly? It seems like, you know, the alternative thing is just to leave the ramble in and make it more this kind of wandery, like, here's my brain. Like, I don't
really I think it's actually sort of faux on authenticity, right? Because things have become so confessional and so, like, you can get dirty and raw about this date you had last night and the sex you had, because this almost competitive nature of I'm so real, you can't stop me. But it's also fabricated. It's just a different generation's idea. Like, I always thought the idea that there was an alternative comedy scene was a joke in itself. Right. I was like, yeah, you're doing humor, doing it differently. And admittedly, I look at the Catskills comics and I would never do that kind of comedy.
Right.
You know, bada bang, bada boom, bada boo, you know, like that. I couldn't do it. So you kind of speak to your generation, or you find your voice and people come along or they don't. But I think if once you start to have that sense of who you are and the way you tell things, I lean towards nostalgia. I lean towards some kind of retro sense of looking at my family's Kodachrome slides and telling stories, which is different than somebody else. And, you know, I really appreciate whether a person's clean or dirty when they have a perspective that's all their own. Derivative of the wave is not interesting to me.
Yeah, it's, you know, I've watched, to me, like, when I see this stuff and the difference, and I agree totally, as you move through major epics of style, it's really hard to go back and watch the old styles until, like, they get so far away that they're kind of, you know, sticky and it's fun to watch, but not in an enjoyable way, just kind of like, oh my God, look at the way they talk. Like watching Bob Hope. If Bob Hope, but I tell you, if he was around now, he'd still be the funniest comic. He would just talk differently. Mm. And I watched a lot of the New York comics, like Louis C.K. and these guys, you know, Jim Norton, who were still punchlines. They're just breaking it up and they're making it seem halty and dialogic, but it's still great punchlines, you know?
Yeah. Well, I punched up for somebody a monologue they were doing, and it was a female actress who was working on something she had to host. And what was really interesting was the note that came back, a little too jokey. And yet what she was asking for in parenthetical was better joke here, something funnier here. Can you make this funny? So yeah, that's what I did.
Punchlines, right?
Yeah.
You tell them however you want, break them up, make them seem more authentically spoken. But the punchline is the punchline is the punchline.
Well, here's what I do think. I think you can write colorful stories. And again, I would say this for an actress or somebody else that's a speaker. Punchlines can be detrimental to somebody who doesn't know how to do comedy. But colorful, like colorizing a story, you know, coming up with the right phrase or a different way to say a thing can serve as a punchline. So, you know, she was actually wanting to talk about complications on her lady parts, and she was just using vagina, you know, and I went,
vagina.
I was like, look, you're asking me to punch up your vagina joke, which is already problematic for a guy like me. But I said, what if you just said something's not right down in the dollhouse? That is an image. Then you're like, what's going on?
Yeah,
right.
It's to work with.
It's just classier or craftier or something. And that is probably one of the more unusual jobs I've done in the last few weeks, but not one that I should be talking about, but
you know, you see all this stuff with, like, I learned this when I was writing at Dennis Miller. Dennis was great and his writers were great, you know, at this format of getting jokes on the way to the, getting laughs, get on the way to the punchline with great images and great asides and great phrases. Like, he'd get 10, 12, 15 laughs on the way to the punchline or more, because it took him a long time to get there to the main thing. And when you see that, you're like, oh, I can really wrangle each three words or every word and get something from it. Then that's the kind of writing, when I see it, I'm just like super, you know, impressed by just the craftsmanship of what they've done. And you can do that in stories. It doesn't matter. You can drape punches all the way through stories, or you can do it in rants or set up punch. It doesn't make any difference. Still the quality of the angle that you come up with.
And I think that in some ways, probably George Carlin did this quite well, is that it is a bit musical. there's a rhythm to it. The right word is a very important word, but also the words around it. And it's sort of like, okay, we're going to gallop up to this. Now we're going to make a twist and then we're going to hit you over the head, all of that. And yeah. People do it differently. Different comedians do it differently. A person like Wendy Liebman, who I don't know if your listener but she always does.
Yeah.
Her humor is on the aside and it's kind of, it falls off at the end and it's after what feels like the joke is the follow-up moment. And what's interesting about that is you have to have a certain amount of confidence because sometimes you'll go on a stage following a bunch of people with a different musical rhythm and you have to reset the room and you just have to go at it until they go, wait a minute, she's doing it differently.
She's doing a thing here.
I remember there was a guy named Jeremy Hotz. I think he's a Canadian comedian.
Yeah, the guy.
Man, that's a guy I didn't want to follow because he was funny, but he had his own, like he would just get people on his wavelength and get going. And to reset after him was like, oh, you know, they're just so supercharged. I mean, he's hilarious, but it is different. You know, it's like, hey, you're going to play your, you know, kaleidoscope after this guy finishes that Dixieland jazz, you know?
Yeah. I've talked to my buddy Kostaki about this. Like there's a phenomenon that a few comics have because their delivery is so strong. Brian Regan does this to other comedians. I've worked with Brian 3 different times for full weeks. And for the next month, you're just hearing Brian Regan in your head with everything you say. And if you apply his delivery over to your jokes, they become so much funnier. You're like, I wish I could talk like that.
He also had a trick, which I don't think he knew about, but is one of his things, or especially early on, is that he would almost go into a squat when he would do the punchline. He would be doing it, and then he'd come down. And
Nobody knows like Regan.
Right? Yeah. And the only reason I know it is that a long time ago, I was writing intros for a Aspen Comedy Festival, and he was one of the young comics, and they sent me videotape at the time, and I was shuttling through it fast, and which meant I couldn't hear the words, but he was like a jack in the box. He was popping up and down. I was like, what is this guy doing? You know, it was
I always use him whenever I teach early stand-ups who are trying to learn the formats. I'm like, just watch all the things he's doing, like vocal tones, delivery, face, body movement. It's just all cueing of nobody moves like that.
And I mean, I think there's many a comic. Jerry Seinfeld is somebody that I knew the rhythm of and was a mechanic in his shop. But there is a time that you have to move on from working on somebody else's Porsches and Mercedes, because otherwise you become that voice. And it is interesting. I think I remember writing one routine about the steering wheel in the car being in the wrong place. And it was a great joke, but it was in Jerry's rhythm. And eventually I just had to stop doing it because I would be at a club and people go, is there a Jerry Seinfeld joke? I go, nope. It's just, I wrote it that way. You know, it was about your hands. They say drive with your hands at 2 and 10 o'clock, right? Who's doing that? Right? People are driving one-handed, thumb, elbow, or their knee, going 85 through a school district, open handgun on the seat, you know, rolling down the window. Why don't we put the steering wheel in the back seat where the people actually know how to drive are located, right? That's like Jerry's signature sting, you know?
Well, like I said, we're clearly writers, so we jump right into writing, you know, talk. But let's go back and let's talk a little bit about the career of Pat Hazel. So just run us just real quick, like your background, how you got into all this, just the backstory of that.
All right. I'm going to make it the nickel tour because it's not that interesting.
That's all right.
But
that's
I started out as a kid with a magic kit. So I learned magic tricks. And in doing the magic.
Schubert did that too.
Who did?
Jimmy Schubert.
Oh, okay.
He performs at the Comedy and Magic Castle as a magician.
Yep, I did all of those things, before I even did that, I just realized that in learning the tricks, and they would sometimes go awry or fail, I used humor as my insurance policy to just go through it. The interesting thing about it was it actually gave me an act. So by having magic tricks and teaching myself to juggle, I had a structure which I could make jokes around, which was very safe way to go into it. Because at least at the end, you can go, was this your card? And then they go, yep. And then it was like, oh, it worked, right? Like that was an ending to any routine. So in the meantime, I really loved working with, people would come up on stage and I would cut their tie up or I would do whatever. And all the interplay with the other person is what a comic does when they're interacting with an audience and they're finding out where they're from and what they do for a living. So I was getting a sort of accelerated comedy learning out of bringing people up to cut a piece of rope and put it back together and, you know, take off a person's bra with some silks or whatever the trick was. That was just sort of, hey, this is the thing. Now make fun of what I'm seeing.
Right. Yeah.
And it was, that was young. And I lived in Omaha, Nebraska. And then by the time I went to make my move to California, I realized, okay, I got to set the magic aside. If I'm going to go onto a new scene and do a new thing, maybe I'll just go for the comedy alone. And it was tough. It was a tough initially because I had grown, I could do this other stuff.
The rabbit. You loved.
Well, I didn't have a rabbit. I did have a one bird that didn't do anything. I called it son of a bitch because I was always trying to get it to come back. I go, come back, you son of a bitch. So that was the name of the bird. But I realized that to get on to the Tonight Show or get that stage at the Improv, I didn't have the luxury of carrying a box full of shit on stage. Like there was no room. You walk up through the crowd, you turn around, you're on, right?
You could have been Carrot Top or the Amazing Jonathan if you'd adjust.
Yeah, I didn't have enough duct tape to be Carrot Top, among other things. No, I don't unappreciate people that can make things. I do like props, and it's evident when you look at my playwriting that there are times that I rely on the scenery or other things people are handling, how they handle a phone or a phone cord or something. You can get miles of humor out of that stuff. And I love that. So that is the theatrical side of my brain. And I realized, oh, I can do that in a theater. I don't have to have, it doesn't have to be in the form of a magic trick. But also maybe you'll understand this. I don't know if the listener will, but there's quite a bit of difference between being a monologist and writing dialogue and where the humor belongs and whether or not, like, everybody in a scene isn't funny. I think in some ways when sitcoms became like everybody's doing punchlines all the time, it was a little cloying to me to say, hey, it's okay if they have different styles of humor. Cheers was a good example of they had specific kinds of humor they would do. And they would go to the bartender for one-off, but they would go, you know, for something between Norm and, you know, the postman or whatever. Right. So there were ways that these little pods of humor would surprise you.
Right.
But sometimes it's just a little too much. Like every kid on the sitcom is cracking a joke and then the mom is and then whatever. And you're like, hey, well, is there a story
it
here?
It becomes this hyper stimulation environment where every line has to be, you know, nobody wants to be the setup, right? Like Carla would come in on Cheers and just, you know, just wreck the place with a crushing line and then she'd be gone.
Right.
You know, and nobody wants to be the straight guy anymore.
Yeah, but you look back at the great straight men or the people who made scenes work or you did whatever, you know, I think Phil Hartman used to be a guy that
perfect.
He could be a normal dude in a sketch and be hilarious because he was so generous in those scenes with people. Yeah. And, you know, I guess, you know, Steve Carell on The Office is quirky and funny and whatever, but it's more his strange, selfish, unaware, whatever. It's the vibe that makes him funny more than the words.
Yeah, he doesn't chew up every piece of the scenery. He leaves stuff for other people. And I agree with all that.
So I went through that. And then I had a couple of interesting challenges, which was that I was touring and opening for Seinfeld. This was prior to the sitcom.
How did that happen? How did you get in with Jerry?
I think I worked at the Comedy Magic Club in Hermosa Beach, and I worked at a few different places. And at the time, I still pulled out the tricks, you know, I would juggle top hats. I would do whatever. And he liked what I did. And he liked what the crowd, you know, how quickly they got warmed up. So he asked me to open for one of his first specials, which he shot at the Roxy in Hollywood. Nice. And, you know, I wasn't filmed on the special. I was just there to get the studio audience going. And along the way, somewhere down the line on the road, he said to me, you know, you can come, just bring a suit bag and just do stand up. And I thought it was really avuncular. And I thought he was you know, like mentoring me. What I came to discover after a week of it, which was went fine, is that he didn't want to wait for my shit, my luggage to come out because it had the props.
That sounds like a way a stand-up actually approaches his career and everything else.
They do. It's efficiency, right? It's like, what do I need? I need a watch to know what time it is. I need a stool and a thing of water. And then I'm good with a microphone. Yeah, that's all they need.
Yeah. Larry the Cable Guy / Dan Whitney was here at the Irwin Center. And I went down to see him and hung out a little bit. And I was, he had two tour buses with him. And I'm like, hey, Dan, what's the second tour bus for? Your extra shirt sleeves that you've cut off your shirts? And he laughed a little bit. But I'm like, two tour buses for a guy with a microphone? Come on.
Wow. Well, they end up living, some of those people, I don't know if I could do that kind of touring. I'm on the road a lot, but I like the comforts of a hotel and room service and other things. Yeah. You know, I don't think, you know, I made a little joke earlier about cruise ship comics. It's that's another whole nother world. And but it's, just the idea of being stuck in a small cabin and then being on a building, you can't get off, where the audience has all seen your show. You can't just read a book poolside without somebody sending their kid over. There's the comedian, you know.
Yeah, do something funny.
Yeah. So I think I dodged that bullet. But also I moved to theaters fairly early, and it took a bit of a road to go down, but I wanted to get rid of the variable middle and opening act that could be a regurgitator or, you know, like,
oh my God,
do weird, super filthy stuff and then say, here's your headliner. Like, I was like, I got to get rid of that. Or blended drinks. You know, the whole, one of the arts you learn is how to get through the checks dropping. Yeah, you know, like, what am I going to do? I'm on a roll. My act is reaching this point. There's 3/4 mark. Every waitress comes through, starts to drop the checks. People start to look at them. They wonder who had what, you know, and it's like, you've got to write a bit for that because that's going to take 3 or 4 minutes till you can have their attention.
Clubs like Appleton did this. I know they would drop the checks after, like, do the whole show, and then they'd be like,
that's awesome.
And then you're going to pay. And everybody got used to it, so it worked fine.
It wasn't like that in the 80s and 90s. It was like,
no,
they would introduce you, and about 3 minutes in, they would start blending margaritas, you know, you know. And, you know, you just have to make a call. Do I reference that or do I let it go?
Yeah, so you were like in the heyday of stand-up. So you got in with Seinfeld and you start opening for Seinfeld, and then you sort of moved off and started headlining your own shows, that kind of stuff.
I did. I had written a play with another guy called Bunk Bed Brothers, and that was just an attempt to really try to pitch a sitcom, essentially, was why we wrote that. And it ended up being the very script that we were able to turn into Castle Rock. And Matt Goldman and I, who co-wrote that, got the first two jobs as writers on Seinfeld after Larry and Jerry had written the pilot. They were in search of some more people on the team. And that was our writing sample, essentially. So
Castle Rock or through Jerry?
Well, Jerry knew of me, but we had to submit the stuff to Castle Rock. That was the production company. And I'm sure they talked behind closed doors about things and that sort of thing. At the beginning, you know, the structure, which had fallen away, it was Jerry played a stand-up comic. And so we actually had some monologist humor that was filtered through the show that tied into the story.
Yeah, I totally remember when it came out in the summer. It was a summer release. And I'm like, oh, this is cool. Because I just started doing stand-up. And I'm like, oh, look at that. There's a little bit of backstage here. And,
yeah. So I used to write a lot of that stuff with Jerry. But, you know, to Larry's credit, he recognized that was taking away valuable story time.
Right.
And so it was like, no, we know he's a comedian. We're not to prove it. Let's just lose that. And I don't know really how many episodes they used that in, but you know, certainly the first couple of seasons or first season and a half or something. But it started under a very unusual thing, which is it wasn't a traditional primetime budget from the network. They didn't really have the money. That was all assigned. It was somebody a guy named Rick Ludwin, I think, who came from Late Night and Specials. And he found money that was supposed to be for some Circus of the Stars specials or whatever they did, one-offs. And they gave him, I think, just 4 episodes,
yeah, I think
which were independent specials. And they didn't really know where to put it or where to program it. And so it didn't really find its sea legs until sometime later when I think when it, there was, even when there was a, the Gulf War or something, they had to move it for breaking news all the time. Sure. But I think when it finally landed after Cheers and the must see TV thing was or whatever, it sort of got this, you know, all the eyes came to it at about the right time. So,
yeah, no, it was, you know, I look at that stuff and I've talked about this for, to different people. Like to me, like Jerry's very, you know, sort of public consciousness, like how to make everything clean, how to make it clever, but not too clever, how to, you know, work the middle of the country, that kind of stuff. And then Larry's, you know, very arcane, very absurdist, very, you know, kind of humor, like not arcane, but urbanist and peculiar humor. Like neither one of those, I think, would have worked on their own. But when you blended them into a single voice, it just, you know, became something nobody had seen before.
Yeah, and they were quite astute about our generation. I think the biggest shift was all these shows before the Cosby Show or any of that kind of stuff was about a family, right? When you would see that, and there were always parents and kids, and you know that was going on all over the TV. This was the first time that your friends were your family, and it was out there. And you know, then you see from that moment that Friends is that way, and right. Ellen was that way, and the single guy was that way. Like everybody said, yeah, let's just, you know, we'll have the parents on occasion, but they're not, it's not built around that structure. So that was of its time in many ways, as crazy as it was.
Yeah. So when you worked on that, was that a traditional sitcom environment? You guys write in a room or?
I don't know what.
It seemed like you just submitted.
No, I mean, it had some structure. I mean, it, in the very beginning, and I really wasn't there that long as a writer, but because there was only four of us there. So when you talk about writing in a room, we would get assignments and we would go off. We would write an episode, bring it back. We might talk through it or punch it up or do something as a group, but which I think that they grew to do that when they had many more writers. But, you know, we were busy trying to get our episode out. And then Larry had a very, really the strongest voice as a writer of the four of us. And so you'd write this episode and I was new at it, but, and you were so proud. And then he would take it home for the weekend and he would rewrite everything but the title. And he'd go, yeah, now this is better. And what I came to understand when I was writing my own shows later is that the voice is very specific.
Right.
And a thing just doesn't land right, or it's not right the right tone, or, you know, and I had, I wouldn't call them differences like a contentious conflict, but we were from different cloth. So I was Catholic and he was Jewish and I grew up in the Midwest and he grew up in New York. And so though that the things that I thought were funny about riding in the back of a country squire wagon were not, you know, what he knew from the big city or the Catskills or whatever. So, you know, you start to find your place in that world. Can you talk, can you create stories in that, that the creator of the show can embrace?
Right. Well, and you told me once so anecdote about tenting houses, like he didn't believe.
Yeah, but that happened to me in Los Angeles and my apartment got tented for termites and it was a pretty big complex and a tent was over the whole thing. And the landlord was a real cheap bastard. And so he had a big meeting of the community and said, find somebody else here and I'll get hotel rooms. Like randomly, we were going to have to bunk up at the Hilton with some. And so I thought it would be a funny premise for Jerry to have to spend the night with Newman in a room or for, you know, create something. And he could not get over the tenting of the bill. He goes, that never happens. And I think what he meant was it doesn't happen in New York, but he kept saying it. It doesn't happen. I go, no, it's happening because it's happening to me. And then I found myself in one of those spiral Curb Your Enthusiasm arguments where, you know, Larry's twisting his head and you're like, Larry, you don't have to use it. Just admit. And he's like, it doesn't happen. I go, it does happen. You know, and it's like, you want to be right, but there's no point in it.
Right.
But
okay.
I mean, he,
so he did a little stint there at Seinfeld. Tell me where you went next.
Well, I think, I went off to do my own stuff. And one of those things was the Wonder Bread Years, which was a one man show that I took around to theaters. But I also wrote episode of Lois and Clark, which was a Superman show. And then I wrote on a show called Love and War, which was a romantic comedy that there was a lot to, there was a good cast and it was a Diane English thing. So she's a super pro and, you know, getting content out. But that also becomes repetitive, you know, when you have a romantic comedy and the leads don't really come together,
right.
They're always almost going to kiss, you know, at that point it's difficult. So, you know, the timing was right there. I produced another play and also in somewhere in all of this, I was a studio audience warm-up comedian to make some side money. You know, that was from drawing a short straw on Seinfeld as a writer. And it was very naive that we kept going, why do we need a warm-up comedian? We're all funny. And it's right. Like, you're so busy making a show. You can't afford to throw a man over the rail to chat with people. But I did that for 70 episodes or something. Even after I wasn't a writer there, I would come in one day a week and have dinner with the cast and, you know, open up. And it's a thankless job, honestly. Oh, but yeah, that was the fastest way that I could make money to produce plays, which takes money. So I would just, it was like being a losing boxer in a ring. I got to stay up. If I stay up till the end of the show, they'll give me some money and I'll go produce a play.
I admire guys who do really good warm up. There's a guy, Gary Cannon, that's been a warm up forever in LA. And when I was at Best Dance Sports Show period, Brody Stevens, who, you know, had a big career.
He was a funny guy.
He would do warm up and it was really hard to get audiences because Best Dance was 5 days a week and they'd bust in, you know, high school kids from, you know, the worst parts of LA just to get they would be there for the experience. And he had to do warm up for those guys. And I was like, Brody, man, you are just fearless. He would just go and no matter who it was, he'd do his thing.
You learn not to care that much. And you also don't judge yourself. If you get a laugh or you don't get a laugh, who cares? Right.
Right.
Like nobody, by the way, volunteers to take that over from you. Like you just have to quit and then they have to grab some other idiot. Right. Like it's like, but you do learn to make sense out of the night. And I never did what people did where they gave away t-shirts and candy and all of that, but it becomes a rhythm of how do I get this, you know, launch these monkeys into space. And you just make it happen. And I mean, many years after I had not done it and was happy never to go back to it, Coach was doing a remount and this was, I don't know, maybe it was 7 or 8 years ago. They suddenly said, or maybe 5 years ago or something. They said, hey, we're going to remount Coach. And I got a call from one of the writers and the creator that they said, we want you to do this one. Like, we're going to come back strong. We're going to do it like old school. And I was like, I don't know, you know, and it was quite angsty for me because it was like post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Those are their own chops, man. Once you're out of the rhythm of that stuff, you don't want to just drop back into it.
Yeah. And I didn't know what to do. Like, I was like, okay, the audience has a different way, why they're here and all that than they used to. It used to be really exciting if you were on the lot of Universal and they said, hey, would you like to see a sitcom taped? But once people go to it once and know that it takes 4 or 5 hours and that it's unbelievably boring between scenes and all of that, like, under no circumstances, I can't make the time. So I remember for some reason I had this prop, which was, it's called a Brannock device. It's the thing they measure your foot in at the shoe store, that kind of weird metal thing that they slide on your toe. So I threw that in a backpack I had, out of act of desperation. I thought, oh, if we ever have a long scene change, I'm going to play what's in the bag. And we're going to do like 20 questions and that's going to fill all the time. And it did because it was such a weird item that it took forever. And people are like, come on, what do you mean? Wait a minute. It's bigger than a loaf of bread. Yeah, kind of. Well, it depends on your loaf of bread. You know, like I was trying to give them hints, but I just remember how relieved I had that in there. I was like, you know, it was like having a life vest.
That's awesome.
Just, okay, I got to stay afloat out here. for another 10 minutes.
The I'm just going to odd use of something that was never designed to be used in that way, maybe ever.
Right. And by the way, a time when you fly with it in your luggage and they're like, they have these in other towns. Like, you don't have to bring your own foot. And by the way, as an adult, I don't know when you last put your foot in one, but you look in your old shoe and that tells you the size. Like, you don't have to have, so people at airports,
you're not evolving every 6 months.
Security really was like, are you a shoe salesman? And I was like, no, you know, so great. I mean, I learned to not care about that either, but
yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So warm up. And then Mike Fry said this to me last week when I interviewed him, he said he saw you pop up on your own sitcom or something.
I created a sitcom called American Pie for NBC. And that was actually I would say that was graduation day for the bunk bed brothers, because the play had been produced and there was a run on it for the rights to it. And Columbia TriStar and somebody else were battling it out. So it was first written as a feature film, and we wrote three or four different screenplays about these brothers, and they never made it. And then when the rights ran out, NBC jumped on trying to figure out how to make it a sitcom. So it was a TV pilot, and I starred in it with a guy named William Ragsdale, was my brother. And this was sort of my moment. You know, there's timing. And if you don't, you know, if you don't like get right in the pipeline of the wave, you know, you just get thrown out onto the beach. But but they gave me the money and the personnel and the whatever to make this sitcom. And they liked the pilot enough that they ordered 6 episodes of it. And so that was really fun. We got to write our own thing and create our own crazy cast of characters and all of that. And we went through some of that exercise. And then I was a producer, so I was learning all the chops of hiring directors and casting people. And it was really super fun to make, but we were we were the little engine that could, right? We just had 6 episodes and we were battling it out, and we didn't even know there was no studio space. And so NBC said, well, all the directors that are good are assigned to shows. And part of it was that there was a pattern in the week that one, like Seinfeld, I believe, shot on Wednesday, Thursday. And other shows shot on Monday, Tuesday. So those were the days the camera crew came in and they did their camera blocking and they shot it and whatever. And that was it, you know, Frasier, whatever. You worked on a show for a few days as a crew member. But they all had the weekend off. And so I made this really out of the box pitch, which was, we're going to shoot on Saturday, Sunday. And they go, no, we can't do that. We have to pay overtime. I go, no, you're not going to have to pay overtime. They don't work for the same people. It's up to them if they want to take. They go, well, nobody will take that work. Well, not only LA, but it was a very interesting window, October, November, leading into December. And I used the pitch. It's only, instead of we're stuck with little 6 episodes, I go, it's only 6 episodes in 6 or 7 weeks. You can get all your Christmas money. You can not even touch the money you make on those big shows. And it was really I wouldn't even say artful salesmanship. It was like an easy thing. And so we got the hairdresser from Friends. We got the set designer from Seinfeld. Yeah. But we couldn't get one director. So we had 5 directors that did 6 episodes. One guy did 2. And they were all really great. And they all had fun. And we couldn't get on the lot where everybody was. So I had this really, really good line producer. And I said to him, what is a soundstage made of? It's just a big warehouse. He goes, well, it has to be soundproofed. You have to have a rail for the microphones and you have to have stands for that. I go, what does that take? And he goes, let me find out. And this dude found a place in Van Nuys that was, you know, just looking to rent out their warehouse. And he convinced the guy who was renting, he just showed him everything. He said, this is how much it will cost you to convert to a studio that you can use, you could rent forever. And the guy goes, what? He's like, yeah, this 6 shows is going to be gone. Somebody's going to be just as desperate we are, you know, and you can do it on Monday, Tuesday. Like, he kind of just outlined what the space could be used for. So he put in dressing rooms. He put in, you know, enough for
your own sound stage.
And that thing still operates out there, you know, in Van Nuys. And, you know, he really made it happen. That guy was like, okay. But it also meant we weren't near everybody. Like, we weren't in Burbank and we weren't, you know, in Studio City with all the other exciting shows, just on our own. But I think because we were on our own, we were able to tell our own stories and cast our own people, and we weren't being meddled by the networks. And, you know, subsequently they didn't know who we were. Huh. So when it was time to put us on, they're like, we were in a life raft somewhere eating our own supplies, basically, you know. But it's a very interesting show to see, because we did have decent guest stars and funny talent. And ultimately, when the network started seeing the pieces of it, they started to, it was as if it was a car they were taking apart for parts. Like, they go, hey, that actor's really funny, let's move him over here. Hey, this is good, let's, you know what I mean? We had kind of brought in this ragtag group of really interesting people, and they went on to be on other things and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so, man, that's sounds like a lot of energy, a lot of Nova energy, build, and then damn it.
Yeah, I mean, I think in our business, there's always grieving over the loss of an opportunity, or you even have a success and you got to make a second album, or you got to do something, right, and you have to top yourself. But I think that particular thing, I wrote it off as film school. I was like, I got a intense ability with my ideas to write something, produce something, perform in it, see what parts of the business, man, I like.
To grad school, just right there.
Totally. And they paid for it, right? So I'm like, hey, cool. And I don't know that I would have ever had a house if I didn't have just a little modest, you know, nest egg or something, right, for a deposit, because you rent until you can have a chunk of money. Even if it's $20,000, you can't get that in stand up out of the blue, right, you know?
Yeah.
So it started me on a path, I think, to just being more disciplined about my writing. And, you know, eventually when I pulled out of Hollywood and was focused more on theater, I was writing and directing and producing with a bigger goal, which is that my playing field is now America. I know better than be global, because my humor is very Americana and very, you know, relates on the English language and, you know, just rhetoric and persuasion that you talk about. I don't know how to translate that to other cultures. It doesn't really connect for me, you know?
I think that's one of the things. So you had Hollywood, but you also were running plays at the same time, and you swerved over into live theater and these regional theaters. So talk about that, because that's a world nobody ever, I think, from Hollywood. When I came back here in Austin and we met up and I started hearing about what you're doing, I'm just like, oh, that's a thing? Like, I didn't even know that was a thing.
Nobody in Hollywood still doesn't think it's a thing. And until they can super exploit it, meaning,
right, sure,
when a Broadway show, like the producers come, which was based on a movie that was not a musical, right? It comes full circle. Yeah, you have this thing that's a play that, you know, or a screenplay or whatever, but it becomes this musical. It becomes this wildly popular musical, and then it becomes a movie again, but in a musical form. Like, they'll take anybody's, you know, a prize winning cow from the fair, they're ready to take and butcher, right? But they won't look at it when you're feeding it seed corn. That's like, that cow's never going to be anything.
Wow,
and they, you know, and so what they do is they shop at Sundance, and they shop at Cannes Film Fest. They go where the prize cows are. And then they go, now we're ready. Now that there's a full gust of wind in your sail, we're ready to take over the boat, you know?
Yeah,
but they don't want to build the boat, and they don't want to, you know, train the crew, and they don't want to do any of that kind of stuff. And, you know, I speak, you know, across the board about it, because that's the nature of saving the money. It's just don't development costs money, and it's a gamble. So right. How do we get rid of the gamble? And one of the things, they
all these little solo creators out there and let them do all the work.
Yeah. But I will say that the change in production, for example, things like Netflix and so forth, they are actually giving the helm to creators and to authors and people who could give you a story arc. And they're not threatening to cancel you every minute. What they're saying is, you can have a season and you can do 13 of these and we'll drop them all at once because the habit of the viewer is the binge watching. So it used to be episode two, they could pull the plug on you. Episode three, they could pull the plug on you. Like the threat was hanging over your head like a guillotine.
Let's come back to that one because I think that we have lots of things we could talk about. Maybe we'll do another episode at some point, but like stay with the regional theater, like explain that to people because they don't really understand that everybody gets Broadway, right? And some people don't even know that there's more theater in the world than Broadway.
Well, there are certain towns that are great at it. You know, Chicago has great theater. Minneapolis has great theater. And really many towns have a few great theaters, but they don't always produce. Sometimes they present, which means that they take a traveling show or a touring thing and they invest in that particular thing and they pay for it. And then, you know, they market it in a way that they hope the ticket buyer, you know, that they can make money off of it. And so they do look for the best, whatever that programming is. Is it dance? Is it music? Is it theater? Whatever it is.
Steel Magnolias is coming through and that kind
right.
of.
Right. Yeah. And some of them are community theaters where people, actors build their chops and so forth, which is that they do it through grants and they fundraise through the community and they do all of that kind of stuff. But I think, you know, I came to discover that there was a range of theaters that were right for my kind of stuff. And they, in order for it to financially work, they range from about 300 seats to maybe 1500 seats. And it became a math problem. So how much is the seat worth? What's the average ticket price? How many shows do we have to do to make the nut? So if a theater had 300 seats, might have to do 5 shows in that town or 1 show in the 1500 seat place, right? And then can we realistically sell that? Does my name or my show or my idea warrant that? Well, the smaller the town got, the bigger my value got, if that makes sense. Meaning small town Wisconsin has a jewel box theater and nobody comes through there. So then having 1 or 2 writing credits or having been on the Tonight Show was like a guy's coming. If I did that in the heart of Chicago, it would be nothing. You know, they would go, hey, I'm going to the Bulls game. No, I'm doing that. There's so much to distract them. So I started to focus on all of those touring houses and even places that maybe they did 4 or 5 shows a year, but they didn't have a theater piece. They had lots of bands, country bands coming through, different things. And I just looked for the right niche. And then I started to go into arts conferences and learning about how it worked and what they were looking for. And partly why I have such a robust catalog of shows is that sometimes I learned that a singer-songwriter night was affordable and I could sell them. I could curate that, or stand-up comedians are very low tech. We talked about what they need, right? So, and then I can trust each one of them to do their content. So I'm not having to write a new play if I put 3 comedians on each for a half hour. It's the same 90 minutes that I do in a 1-man show, but I can't turn 90 new minutes every year and come back there. So I had to create what I called a bumper crop until I could get my next piece ready. Right. And then, but in the meantime, what I was building, the gold standard of that is a database. So if I could sell tickets in Racine, Wisconsin or Toledo, Ohio, then I could come back with that same and say to people, from the guy who made this. And then you're kind of creating a cachet with your vibe, you know, what your brand is.
Right.
And I was kind of known for baby boomer humor, you know, just anything reflective and slightly sophomoric and, you know, not Pulitzer Prize winning kind of thing.
Yeah, but you know, people don't respect what it takes to write something that, not vanilla in a negative term, but vanilla is in a positive term of, it's pleasant enough for everybody to get enjoyment out of it without chocolate chips in it or, you know, having to spike it with something else. It's just good, solid, pleasant experience. And that's
well, here's the thing. It's like winning a People's Choice Award. Okay. Like that's what I like. I like people to like it, but I'm not going to necessarily get a Nobel Prize. I'm not going to change the world with this content. But if people are happy and uplifted and leave in a way that makes them feel better, I feel like, okay, I've done my job. not to say that I'm shooting for C plus work, but what I'm after is
Norman Rockwell, right? Like the guy could paint, but he chose things that, you know, had a certain resonance to them.
Yeah, but they didn't look at him in his day as the same kind of fine artist as we see him now.
Right.
So, and then when he was on the cover of the magazines, the Post magazines and all that kind of stuff, you know, he was endearing himself to us because he was really a storyteller. And we were seeing all what's going on. What are the machinations of this family trip or this moment in the dentist chair or whatever it was? We're like, we relate to it. And so that's the way I write. I don't write about my biography. I write so that the audience can see themselves in the content.
You write America's biography, a certain
in a way, a generation's, yeah. You know, like, so I talk about things. And when they say I did that, I went there, I was on that, you know, I have that picture at the Four Corners, you know, in Utah and Colorado, whatever it is, they, it actually takes them a place that they, that's comforting to them.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. Like, we're not really talking politics in this episode at all, but like, when you look at in a broader political scope, I so like I said, I have the right on here, and I work a lot about converting the right and anti-propaganda and things like that. And but at the foundation of it, when I have this seminar and sort of training people how to convert the right, is like, understand that this is old world America versus new world America. And those are the continents that are crashing together. Like, for a lot of people who have lived in rural America and white America and traditional America, like, they're like, I want to continue this life, but all these things are crushing in. And like, you're just seeing the buckling, you know, of the Teutonic plates. And so don't look at that old world or that, you know, past world as somehow evil or whatever. It should naturally resist that kind of change. That's the nature of cultural conflict. You know?
Yes, but here's the thing. In addition to people resisting change, I think we've become very binary, and that is pick a side, whatever it is, right? So you could talk about
basic,
right and left.
Basic narrativity, right? Conflict. You have to have binaries for conflicts.
Yeah, but you don't is the thing, right? Like I talked to somebody on my podcast the other day where when you think about sports, somebody has to win and somebody has to lose. The game does a tie is unsatisfactory because half the people are wearing one jersey, half are wearing another. Like the results of this is a winner and a loser. And then a score goes up. And then at the end of the week, we're ahead. And next week we want to be ahead again. We're going to the big contest, the Super Bowl, where somebody's going to win and then somebody's going to get the prize. But with the arts, with theater, if it can end where everybody wins, right? Everybody can leave a Broadway musical, singing the thing and feeling bright, whatever. So what I'm not trying to be sugar-coated and rosy-colored glasses, I'm just saying what politics have done over the last 10 years, and it got accelerated, you know, like 4 years ago, it just kept ramping up,
yeah,
is that you are either right or wrong. You're either on my side or you're against me. You're either wearing a mask or you're not. You're either vaccinated or you're not. There's no in between. There's no, nobody's going to, because it's super easy to judge and decide what you want based on that. And yet there's so much nuance where when you think that way, you're no longer solving problems. Nobody's working on the problem. You're working on the team. We need more people on our side of the tug of war so we can change something.
Right. You're right. But ultimately the thing about politics, and I want to get back over to your stuff.
And the thing is, you know, I'm not very political, but I think of it when I'm writing, I think about not turning, like even a joke. I sometimes think, what's responsible for me, right? Pronouns is a big thing right now. And it's something that people are trying to find a voice in being accepted in the world. And people want to know, and other people don't know how to change their thinking on pronouns. And I think of a joke about it and I think, okay, this joke is not a terrible joke and it's not putting anybody down, but I am now making fun of a movement that needs help. And so it doesn't need one more guy. So that's I don't right. use, I put the joke aside. Right. I go, okay, I'm not gonna, that's not really for my material. Right. It might've been if it were if it were a Archie Bunker scenario, right? You might be able to put it in a play where you make a point of somebody who doesn't get it and somebody who gets it. And then the outcome is that people learn from it. But to do it as a monologist is sort of, you know, it's vanity and it's sort of, you're not helping anybody.
That's a very mature perspective, Pat.
I know you would do the joke. I know that, but
no, I would not do the joke. I try not to do a lot of identity politics jokes and things like that. Even though, again, like if you're a comedian and you're wandering around in these areas, you're going to have joke thoughts, right? It doesn't matter what. I just don't do them because kind of like what you're saying. And also because it's a landmine area. And I'm like, I'm not protected in any way in this particular minefield. You know, it's somebody else's minefield. Go over there and work on it. But that's not, I have no experience there. Like, that's what I was saying, kind of you writing about your experience growing up in, was it Omaha?
Yeah, that's where most of my formative years were in Omaha.
Yeah, I mean, that's perfectly valid for you to write about and write as well as you can and capture that experience. What I was saying is that it ends up being a very nice slice of Americana, of a certain type of American experience that's completely valid. And when I see people capture that stuff, you know, I like it. I'm like, that's exactly what I think you should be doing. You're commenting on stuff you know and lived, you know, and if you live in a different culture and you're fighting like the pronoun thing every day of your life, well, great. I want to hear what you have to say comedically about it.
Well, and I think it's transferable, meaning when a movie like Fargo comes along, it's like a foreign language to the people on either coast. And they think it's funny and whatever, but that's how people speak and behave. And, you know, don't you know, that's their, that's the way they talk.
Watch, right?
It is. So you kind of, you know, you can take that journey when it hangs on a murder plot or something else. If you get too inside baseball, you can lose them. But I think that there's a lot where we culturally want to see that other side or that other voice. And, you know, another would be like, hashtag Me Too movement, right? It's a very serious area. And so, you know, I guess one of the challenges as a comedian sometimes is you think a funny thing. And then you go, you know, like I was like, is there any joke there that could be safe? You know, and really it's not a favorable, as you say, minefield to walk into. And this is another one I wouldn't use in my act or anything, but I was like, I was in a menage a trois and they weren't treating me right. And so hashtag me three, right? And, you know, it's like not hilarious. And then I thought,
it's just a joke.
It's just a joke. But right there, I think is where the problem comes. When you say it's just a joke, it isn't if you're making some of somebody's race or if you're making in a situation like that, somebody who's been, you know, had trauma. It's not just a joke. And so I think that's the part of it.
Doing humor for the traumatized, really hard.
It is hard. but the hard part is for us to grow and be educated. So as much as we don't want to change or go, oh, but it's funny. Well, it's funny to you, but it's not funny to everybody. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know that you can be politically correct and save everybody's, like, it's a minefield at a college campus. If you make a joke about anything and they'll say, wait a minute, that's, you know,
it's fascinating. When I went through my act and rewrote it a lot of bits for corporate and just realized how much negativity there was in my humor.
Right. You
know, and even just a negative attitude is just blares like a horn in corporate because everything has to be positive, you know? And so to me, it just became an interesting writing challenge, how to turn it all around to make it acceptable to that culture. And if you're a professional writer, you're always writing under restriction. You're always writing according to what, you know, they want on the show and what they won't allow on the show. And it's fine. It's just a writing challenge at that point. But to me, like when you can get like you and I do, you it's just a meta process. We're not attached. We're not traumatized by these topics. So like, can I turn this into comedy or not? The second level of what is the reaction of traumatized audiences or highly sensitive audiences or basically non-comedy audiences, right? You know, sort of serious audiences. You can't really control that. And I typically just go, that's fine. I'll just stay out of that area.
Yeah. I mean, and the other thing is the word privilege is a word that is triggering to some people. Like, well, I'm not rich. It's like, well, no, that's not really what we're saying. But I would say that you and I come, even at a modest income, there are many privileges of us being male or being a certain age or having an education or having two parents part of our life, whatever happened, being an able-bodied person, like the amount of privilege that isn't even related to economics is what people don't understand when they hear that word is that it relates to the underprivileged. And we're talking about people who have, maybe their family had to sleep in their car or maybe, you know, to get through the night or maybe whatever. And that does exist in a great part of America where a good example would be something that Jerry Seinfeld and I talked about many years ago, which is people can relate to you if you say, I have a car problem. And they're like, oh, I know. But if you say my Porsche broke down,
right,
you're just a prick. Like, I don't give a shit for you. And I'm not really interested in the end of this joke because you have a fucking Porsche.
Right. There's class. I mean, and that's kind of one of the things, like, you're, I think I just counted, you're the 50th white guy, middle-aged white guy I've had on the podcast. I've had 66 Ooh. Interviewees, I think.
You got to change that, buddy.
Well, it's not my fault. These are the guys I know. These are the ones that say yes. I ask, you know, everybody.
I know, but I would challenge you to say that there are so many voices out there. They will say yes if you invite them.
Yeah, I just don't know them. Like, I'm inviting people I know. So I know, but tell people this. Like, okay, so yeah, totally. You can totally ding me on, you know, too many white guys. But out of those white guys, there's a huge range of class. Like, I came from the working class, and I can easily go back to that brutish kind of, you know, right at it sort of approach to life. Versus, you know, all these range of, you know, and where they grew up and all this stuff. So there's a lot of regional distinction. We get caught up in, you know, specific distinctions being the important ones. And I'm like, no, I'm not sure about that. Class for a long time in America was the determining factor. And you're still seeing it. We just don't talk about it as much. You know, it had its heyday with the Marxists and all that kind of stuff. And then it fell out of favor. But, you know, I would put my sort of class range up against almost anybody who's interviewing people out there. I have a huge range of class.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not calling you out to say,
yes, you
I
are.
Know you're,
you can't call me a racist because you're a white guy too, dude.
Wait a minute. Is that what makes me a racist?
Yes. You're a white guy. You're suspect.
Really? Oh, I'm suspect. That's different. I'm racist adjacent is what you're saying.
You're on the way towards racist. We haven't.
No, what I am saying is this, though. You know, again, you know that I started a podcast not that long ago and I'm new to it. So you've been doing this a lot longer than me. But it starts with our thinking about who our guests are going to be, which is, can we amplify voices and can we hear from other, can we hear from other genders? Can we hear from other diversity and other sexual orientation? Like, where our happens to be on creativity. And so I'm like, okay, I still want really creative people. One, I want a good storyteller. I want a different discipline, right? So if I've talked to an author, then I want to talk to a ventriloquist or whatever. I have a mantra, but we're also always saying to ourselves, well, who represents that? If we're going to pick a screenwriter or something. And I think we're finding that the yeses are more, the more diverse and eclectic we get with that, and we don't necessarily know the person, the more we're surprised about the conversation. So, you know, right. you're a smart guy.
You're using the word we.
Two of us.
Did you have a producer helping you?
Yeah.
I just have like me sitting here going, oh, who do I have on Facebook that would be fun to talk to?
I know, here's the thing. You can say who would be fun to talk to based on a book you read or somebody you saw on TV. It is interesting what the pandemic has done, which is everybody has a studio in their house now.
Yeah, that's funny.
And so people can't say, there's no way I can get on a Zoom call. You know, I mean, they can be too busy. But other than that, during the pandemic in its height, you couldn't even say, I got shit going on. You don't have anything going on. None of us do.
No, it's hilarious.
Right? So that's why I started was I thought, the busiest creative people I know, if I'm not working, they're not working.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I got the first guest I had was the chief creative officer of Pixar. Who gets an hour of this dude's time? You know
what
I mean?
You had some big guests.
Yeah, but it was a product of the fact that we didn't talk about COVID and we didn't talk about being stuck. What we talked about is the art, the creativity, the hope. What do we do? How do we do it? The creative process is something that's you can share with other people and they can learn something from. So,
yeah, let's circle back around and put a bow on it. And then maybe we'll come back in at some point in the future and do a thing specifically on your podcast, because I'm interested in that too. But so like you wrote these really, like how many plays do you actually have that are out there making, you know?
I would say five are functioning. Like some of them are, were of their time and don't come back around. But there are five that still, I have a show called A Crotochrome Christmas that pops up in some cities every Christmas. The Bunkbed Brothers kind of goes in cycles because it's got a lot of scenic, you know, it takes some machinery to run the show. There's a set of floating bunk beds and so forth. So we can't just drop it in for one night. But The Wonder Bread Years and a play I wrote called Grounded for Life is now being turned into a musical, which is probably the next likely thing that would resurface, is a repurposed play to musical.
The songs?
I did write with a guy named Larry Goldberg out of New York. And Larry's a great composer. And, you know, he asked me 5 years running, we should write a musical because he liked my plays. And I don't know anything about musicals, or didn't at the time. And now we've got 14 songs, and we did a, just before the pandemic, we did a stage reading in New York with Broadway singers and accompaniment. And it was really, really fun to see an audience watch. It was a stage reading. So what that means is you don't get scenery, costumes. They kind of acted out a little. There's no real formal blocking, but they go from the book, which is the dialogue, to singing, to back to the story and whatever, and watching that audience who was engaged in that kind of reading was really fascinating. It was really like, they got it. They got the joke. They liked the song, or, hey, that's really funny. And it wasn't intended to be. Why is that so funny? Is it the guy's expression? Is it the pause? Like it's a study of how to make a whole quilt out of a series of scenes, you know?
Yeah, that sounds fun. I've always, at some point, I would like to do, you know, some kind of work with watching. I like to watch actors do things and write in dialogue anyway. Like I'm a counterpuncher writer. So the writer's room was always good for me. People would say something and I would, you know, hit it back with a really sharp line that I couldn't have gotten to on my own.
Right.
So that idea of working with writers, and I've worked with so many stand-ups, and I'll make them redo the show over and over and over, because every time I hear a new nuance, a new line. So I like that kind of visual audio down to, you know, creativity. So that the writing plays off those things. So I bet you that was super fun.
Well, I think it was, and both you and I are similar, which is I'm a good collaborator. I have good ideas and so forth, but I like to be accountable to somebody. So if we have to have something for tomorrow at this time, I always think, okay, if I bring 51% or better to the party, I will have helped co-parent this project. And if the other person thinks the same way, then you're ready to work when you get there. But if you blow off today and you come in with 20%, it's just not an equitable relationship.
Right.
So that's one thing. And the other thing is I always referred, when I got to be doing punch up for some sitcoms, it was to me a SWAT team. And I just looked at myself as TJ, the sniper in the tower. Like my job is to have this one punchline when nobody else has it, when we finish watching the run through and they go, that's a turkey. What are we going to do there? I was like, I'd look at the column of my script and I was like, here's three options. Like, I want to solve this problem. Take the guy out with one joke. Right.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Kill shot from 150 yards.
Right.
Headshot. No, I like
being a joke sniper is very, because you also have to be ready. You have to be ready when they, and if the jokes are working, they don't need you. But when they aren't working, they need you now.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's an art. That's definitely an art all of its own. Well, cool, man. I've kept you over an hour.
You're talking to the audience right now too, aren't you? We've kept them here over an hour too.
Hey, you know, if they want to stay and listen, more power to them. If they want to bail and come back later, it's the beauty of, you know, the internet, right?
But I'll do a mini plug. I just want to know. Plug. No, the podcast is called Creativity in Captivity, and it's on all the, wherever the kids are getting the podcasts, it's there. It's a new, exciting forum for me. But what I really am enjoying is that all of these crazy, interesting guests are sharing golden nuggets. So I just get to be lucky sitting in the seat asking the questions. But when I hear the episodes back, I'm like, oh, I should take note of that. That's how a pro does it.
Yeah, it's super fun to let people have, you know, a different kind of forum where it's not just kind of sticky, get to it quick, you know, talk show kind of stuff. It's, hey, take your time with this story and find the interesting parts of it. Really, you know, bring it to life and relate it to people. And you're really good at that. This has been super fun. Like, I don't know, you know, if you understand just how good you are at just sort of filling the space nicely in this podcast format, but stories and everything were great.
Oh, thanks. I enjoy talking to you. You're a smart dude and funny guy. So I thank you for the invitation.
Yeah. And everybody go check out the Creativity in Captivity. You said you've already done like 65 episodes in the can.
I have, but I think we've just uploading our 11th episode tomorrow.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So yeah, check that out. I'm sure I've listened to clips of different pieces and you get big names, like you said, you know, the Pixar and Jason Alexander and just really, really cool artists. So it's fun to listen to. So go check it out. That is Pat Hazel. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Get out there and persuade some people. As usual, they need it.